Good evening. If you would, go ahead and open up to Daniel. That's where we're going to be spending the majority of our time tonight. As Jacob mentioned in introducing the songs he was going to lead, we're going to be talking about lessons from Daniel and how God is in control. I appreciate the songs he led, by the way. They're just really, really powerful messages in all three of them. Our God, He is alive. We're gonna see a character who confesses that here. This is my Father's world. I really like that third verse. Though the wrong seems off so strong, God is the ruler yet. And then the battle belongs to the Lord, that idea of God fighting that battle. Daniel, so if you've turned there, I think oftentimes maybe we take something of a backwards view when we're studying the book of Daniel. We tend to maybe not all the time, but sometimes dismiss kind of the first half of the book as like good children's stories, good stories we can learn lessons from. We tend to focus our application on the faith of the men, right? You know, that look at what these great men of faith were able to overcome. And then we get to the second half of Daniel, and well, honestly, we either just skip it or we focus on really the fulfillment of the prophecies. We like to really get into the minutia, the details, and argue over who and what's being prophesied about, when it's going to be filled, when it was fulfilled, all of that. So we have this view, like today, looking back as the first half are stories to take encouragement from, and the second half are prophecies that prove God's power and inspiration. But when you step back and think about what the original readers of Daniel would have thought about it, I think it would have been a little different. It would have been the first half. These are real stories to real life proof about God being in control. These are real things that happened to real people that prove God was in control, even when it didn't look like He was. And then you get to the second half. And remember, these are all visions for things in the future. And so you've got, they have no idea who these kings are going to be. They've got no way to know that. They can't look back at history and overlay events over specific things that are mentioned in the prophecies and try to narrow down who and what was being talked about to them. It's they're God's people and they're exiles. They're exiled in the land of Babylon. They're exiled away from their home, and they were to read the second half of Daniel and take courage from the fact that as proven in the first six chapters, God is in control and God will always be in control. These visions are meant to instill in the reader an immense amount of trust in God. And trust in His control, and trust that He is fighting for the righteous. That theme, you're going to be tired of hearing it tonight, God is in control. That theme can be seen at the very beginning in the name of the characters. Nebuchadnezzar, the foreign king who conquered Jehovah's people and destroyed His temple, his name, O God, Nabu, preserve my firstborn son. Nabu, he was the patron god of literacy and rational arts and wisdom and considered to be an oracle. So we're going to see where Nebuchadnezzar is constantly going to be turning to his god, only to find that Nabu does not have the power to preserve him. And then the four men who put their trust in God, recognizing that He is in control, they have names that go along with that. They're Hebrew named Daniel, God is my judge. Hananiah, God has been gracious. Mishael, who is what God is? And Azariah, God is my help. And I'm going to use those four names to kind of break up the first six chapters tonight as we go through. So we're going to combine the first two chapters under the title Hananiah. God has been gracious. Let's read the first two verses. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. So from the world's point of view, it's obvious who's in control, right? Nebuchadnezzar, the most powerful man in the world, the ruler at the height of Babylon, at the height of the most powerful kingdom in the world. Nebuchadnezzar is to Babylon what Solomon was to Judah. He expanded it to its fullest extent. No one more powerful than him. But verse 2 reveals something to the reader that the world didn't recognize. That though it looked like he had conquered Jehovah had actually given the people to Nebuchadnezzar. And not only that, he gave those vessels to him that Nebuchadnezzar took and put it in the temple to show that his God had conquered. God gave him those. God gave. That's a theme that's going to be throughout the book, especially in these first two chapters. Verse 9 of chapter 1. Now God granted Daniel favor. Granted there. It's the same word earlier in verse 2. God gave. God gave favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. Verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Chapter 2, verse 21. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. Two verses later, verse 23, to you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Verses 37 through 38, you, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. Hananiah, God has been gracious. He has given these things. Verses 3 through 7, back in chapter 1. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, and to Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar is assimilating these youths into Babylonian culture. He's dedicating dedicating them to his god Nabu, to be his servants. That's exactly what Abednego means, who he changed Azariah's name to, servant of Nabu. He's taking these men who worship a god whom he has defeated and attempting to change their devotion to his own god. And part of that is by bribing them. He's going to bribe them with the best he has to offer from the king's own table, so that they'll see that his God is truly worthy of their service. Verse 8, when Daniel decides he won't defile himself, but Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. I don't necessarily think it's at least just about being kosher. For one, wine wasn't prohibited in the law unless you're a Nazirite. Chapter 10, later in chapter 10, verse 3, he seems to imply that Daniel would later partake of these same things. He's not going to eat now the choice foods and the wine. I believe from the context that the motivation behind Daniel and his friends' actions is to refuse that assimilation, refuse to put their trust in Nebuchadnezzar, in his God, to remove it from their own God. As God's holy people, they refuse to defile themselves by selling their loyalty to the king for the good things he can give them. They refuse to be bought. They refuse to defile themselves. They refuse to put their trust in the king instead of in God. And we know how it ends. Their trust is rewarded. Verse 17, as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Though Nebuchadnezzar would have them learn the literature and wisdom of Nabu, they are instead given wisdom and knowledge and intelligence in every literature by Jehovah himself. Then we get to chapter 2 where Daniel and his friends put that wisdom into action. Nebuchadnezzar is going to have all of the wise men in Babylon killed, put to death. Because Nabu's wisdom has failed them. They cannot tell him the dream and give the interpretation. But Daniel and his three friends, they request compassion from God, and the Lord delivers them. He tells Nebuchadnezzar his dream, along with the interpretation, which is that there will be earthly kingdoms that will come and go, but God's kingdom is everlasting. That's a truth we're going to see throughout the text. God's kingdom is forever. In chapter 3, we're going to put this under the heading Azariah, God is my help. Chapter 3, we find the three men who are offered life for their loyalty, death if they choose not to give it. But they choose to keep their trust in God and face that certain death. They chose instead to say, God is my help. After seeing the vision of the statue with himself as the golden head back in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar decides to build a real-life statue entirely out of gold. So the vision was meant to show that God is in control and his kingdom is everlasting, but Nebuchadnezzar seems to have taken from it, yeah, but I'm the head of gold. That's pretty awesome. Look at the end of chapter 2. Then the king promoted Daniel, literally made Daniel great, and said, promoted Daniel, made Daniel great, and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made requests of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. You know, the king made Daniel great. The king gave him many great gifts, and he made him a ruler. Though chapters 1 and 2 are about how gracious God is, how good at giving God is, Nebuchadnezzar has once again, in a way, placed himself in a position above God, even in his graciousness towards Daniel and his friends. And so chapter 3, whether the image of Nebuchadnezzar, or whether this image he makes is of Nebuchadnezzar himself, some seem to think, or possibly one of his gods, or maybe even it's an attempt to make an image of Jehovah. Whatever, the point is Nebuchadnezzar still thinks he is in control. Verses 1 and 2, Nebuchadnezzar makes an image of gold, then commands everyone to worship, it says, the image that he had set up. Then when he's faced with opposition, Nebuchadnezzar's response is in verse 15. If you do not worship the image that I have made, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? The three men recognize that Jehovah could deliver them because he is in control. But it's interesting what they also admit is that he might choose not to. The point wasn't that they were going to be delivered because of their trust in God. The point was they were going to trust in God whether he chose to deliver them from the furnace or not. And with that, what they're doing is making sure that whatever happens, whether they face death or life, whether they die in the furnace or are delivered from it, that God, his name was going to be glorified. We know God chose to deliver them, and as a result, Nebuchadnezzar glorifies God. In verse 29, he issues a decree that, when you look at it, basically seems to put Jehovah in the pantheon of gods that the Babylonians worship. Verse 29, no one should speak against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego because he delivered them, and no other God can deliver in this way. And so it seems like he views Jehovah as certainly a God who delivers, but really just a God who does good stuff for the people that worship him. That's not an all-powerful God. That's a God who Nebuchadnezzar can control. Nebuchadnezzar seems to have still failed to recognize the ultimate truth of the book of Daniel, that God is in control and Nebuchadnezzar is his tool and not the other way around. But we get to chapter 4, and he's about to learn. Chapter 4, Mishael, who is what God is? Nebuchadnezzar is going to answer that question himself. He has another dream. The last one gave him a big head, a big golden head, pun intended. This one is going to have the opposite effect. Without going into details of the dream, let's look at the purpose and what Nebuchadnezzar has finally figured out. It starts off showing that Nebuchadnezzar is the one telling this part of the story, and he gives us the ending at the very start. Verse 2, it has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. This is the theme of this section, this chapter 4, and just so we don't miss it, it's going to be repeated 5 more times. Verse 17, Nebuchadnezzar is told by an angel that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes and sets over it the lowliest of men. Again, verses 24 through 25 as part of the interpretation. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree, the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that you be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place be with the beasts of the field, and you be given grass to eat like cattle, and be drenched with the dew of heaven, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. When he doesn't learn from this vision, a year later he is told it is now going to take place in verse 32. And you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field. You will be given grass to eat like cattle. 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. And just interesting that back when we read he was going to throw them into the furnace, he said, you know, if you refuse to bow down, immediately you're going to be cast in the furnace. And obviously he was ineffective in fulfilling his prophecy there. But verse 33, immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled, and he was driven away from mankind. God said what was going to happen, and as soon as Nebuchadnezzar acted against him, it happened immediately. And finally, Nebuchadnezzar gets it. After his captives continued to put their trust in God rather than in him, and God continually delivered them, finally he's been humbled to the point that in verse 34 he can say, but at the end of the period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? Now we're going to see a king who doesn't learn that lesson. Chapters 5 and 6, we're going to say, Daniel, God is my judge. So here we take place a while after Nebuchadnezzar's gone from the scene. Belshazzar is put in charge. And rather than learning from the lesson of Nebuchadnezzar, knowing that God is in control and choosing to humble himself, he instead chooses to exalt himself above God. And as Daniel's name suggests, God is going to judge him for that. So what starts it off is Belshazzar throwing this big party and using those vessels. Remember the vessels that we saw God gave to Nebuchadnezzar to put in the temple. These vessels that were used to worship God Almighty. He's going to use them as basically party favors. They're going to be used by it says, him and his nobles and his wives and his concubines to just drink out of at this party. These items that looked like they represented the conquering of Jehovah. When Nebuchadnezzar took his people, they're actually going to be what leads to the destruction of the Babylonian Empire. God is in control. At the end of chapter 5, God judges Belshazzar to be lacking. That's what Daniel tells him the inscription means, that he is numbered. He's been numbered, weighed, and found deficient. So God takes the kingdom away from Belshazzar and gives it to Darius, the ruler of the Medes and Persians. And it says in verse 31, so Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. God gave it to him. Chapter 6, King Darius is now the most powerful man in the world. The ruler of the greatest empire in the world, and what do we see he does? Remember, we've already been conditioned to see that God is in control, that these kings are not able to accomplish what they want to do when it goes against what God wants. And it's almost comical what happens here. The most powerful man in the world accidentally condemns someone he likes to death. And then he has no power to actually save him because he's bound by his own law. Darius wants to save Daniel, but knows he can't. And so Darius, the king, the most powerful man in the world, knows Daniel's God can save him. And then at the end, verses 21 and 22 of chapter 6, then Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him. And also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. God judges Daniel as innocent, and God delivers him because Daniel trusted in him. And we see Darius' response, the mightiest man in the world, in verse 26, I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, our God, he is alive, and enduring forever. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Finally, we have a king who sees what is the reality of the situation, that God is the one who rules forever. And now we get to chapter 7 through 12. And I think the overall lesson is going to be that no matter how bleak it looks, God will always be in control. Chapter 7 and 8 We have a couple of visions that show kings rising up and warring against each other and warring against God. Dominion is being passed around, being given to some, and then taken away. But eventually, in both cases, God will pass judgment on those who oppose him, and the kingdom will be handed over to the holy ones, and they'll possess it forever. Chapter 9. Chapter 9, just if you have time later tonight or something, just read chapter 9. It's a beautiful prayer Daniel says to God, recognizing God's righteousness. It starts off saying he's read Jeremiah and how it says there that it'll be 70 years that they'll be in captivity. And now Daniel's read that. It's been about that long. And so Daniel goes to God in prayer, admitting that the people are in this situation. God is not to blame there, the people are. Admitting that the people sinned against him, and that is why they were given over to Babylon. Recognizing that although they're in a bad situation, God is still in control, and it's happened exactly as he said it would. Even when it seemed like things were bleak, this is what God said would happen, because he is in control. In Daniel 10, starts off with Daniel being in this prayerful mourning for 3 weeks. Perhaps he's wondering, as we often do, whether God is even listening at this point. What's the point? Look at how bad things are. God's forgotten his people. But then an angel shows up. I'm gonna say an angel called a prince. It seems to be these spiritual beings, and we're going to go with an angel. And explains that he was actually dispatched to come to Daniel when he first started his looking for answers, when he first started that mournful praying. But he was being opposed. He was being opposed by another prince, an angel or a demon or something, whatever that is. He was being opposed. It wasn't until Michael joined the fight that he was able to get away. And so we're given this insight into the spiritual forces that are acting behind the things that we see. The angel of Persia is mentioned, the angel of Greece, Michael, is either the angel of Israel or God's people. He wants Daniel to know that God is listening, and beyond that, God is fighting for his will to be accomplished. Chapter 11. If you have time to only read one chapter tonight, read chapter 9. If you've got time to read like 10 chapters, read chapter 11 10 times. It's the culmination of the visions. It's this epic look at the future and all the many kings that are going to take part. I've read it, I don't know, half a dozen times, and I kept trying to like read it to figure out, all right, who's being talked about here? Which king is this? There's a king of the north and a king of the south, and it just keeps talking about them over and over. So many he's and she's, it's hard to keep up with. Even though it seems to go over many, many, many years, at least hundreds of years, that it talks like they're the same person, the king of the north, the king of the south, and finally, like it kind of hit me. That seems to kind of be the point. It's a perfect summation of the futility of it all. What God wants us to understand is that these kings are all the same. One rises up, falls, and another takes his place. It may seem like an endless cycle to us, but maybe we see some as better and some as worse, but as the preacher in Ecclesiastes said, it's all vanity. And if we're not careful, we can find ourselves in the same situation as verse 14, I think. God's people here were seeking to rise up against their oppression. Now in those times many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. See, so you've got God's people here who lift themselves up. There's this rebellion of God's people against their oppression, which they're God's people. They shouldn't be oppressed, but they're doing it not for God's glory. They're doing it to lift themselves up. That's their purpose. They're doing it for themselves, and the result is that they fell down. It's interesting, all of this, these coming and going of kings in chapter 11, God isn't mentioned until all the way into verse 32. In verse 32, God finally steps in to display strength and take action, it says. And at this point, finally, here comes God to just get rid of, like, you think, I don't have to keep reading about these people anymore and figuring out who they are. God's going to step in, take action, wipe everybody out, but it doesn't really go the way you expect. He doesn't just wipe everybody out and immediately hand the kingdom over to the saints like we saw in the earlier ones. Instead, he takes this momentary action, and then it reads like he's rebuffed, like he's almost defeated. And then in verse 36, you see it's all part of the plan. It's until the indignation is finished, as it has been decreed. So even when it looks like God steps in and is rebuffed, it's God is still in control. God is in control. Finally, chapter 12. Chapter 12, Daniel is, well, first there's this, it's the beginning of chapter 12 is just this great look at this future resurrection, which you don't get a lot of in the Old Testament. But then the end of chapter 12, Daniel's conversing with this angel who's told them all of this. And Daniel wants to know, though, how long this vain warring of kings it will last. And he wants to know what will be the final outcome. And I can't help, isn't that something we want to know, how long and what's going to be the result of all this? And his answer comes in verse 13. And I love this answer. But as for you, talking to Daniel, but as for you, go your way to the end. Then you will enter into rest and rise again for your allotted portion at the end of the age. His answer is, don't worry about it. Go your way. If you do that, you're going to receive rest, and you're going to receive your allotted portion when you rise again. That's a powerful ending message for a book about God is in control. Go your way. So this book, it's a lot to do, Daniel, in that amount of time. This book should ask us, should have us asking a lot of hard questions. The first, has God been gracious to me? Hopefully everyone here, yeah, that's a resounding yes. He sent his son, he gave his son to deliver you from death, and he continues to be gracious to you when you don't deserve it, right? God is gracious. But then how do I respond to that grace? Go back in chapter 1, have I traded in my loyalty to God for a bribe? So politics today are really not that much different than they were in Daniel's time. We're always being asked to trust in a man, because this one is different from all the others. You know, I know you've had the king of the north, king of the south, king of the north, king of the south, but this guy, he's from the west. He's cool. Like, he'll give you everything you want. And they're always trying to buy our loyalty. And too often, I'm afraid, we allow ourselves to be bought based on who helps us the most, who gives us what we want. And so then the question is, what do I want? What do you want? What is the price of my loyalty? Economic success and the riches that come from it? The king's choice food and wine, so to speak? Have I removed my trust and placed it in a ruler for the promise of security? We all want to feel safe, right? What about, I mean, this is America. Have I done that for freedom? There's no more important thing in this country than freedom. I think more Christians in America have sold their loyalty for freedom than for anything else. I want to look at two hot button topics real quick. They're not morally equivalent, but I think they get the idea across. Let's look at abortion and guns, gun control. Each side frames their argument against one of them as being pro-morality, saving children, right? Anti-abortion, stop killing babies, it's the right thing to do. Seems obvious. Anti-gun, stop letting kids die in school shootings, it's the right thing to do. The other side of both arguments is made from a desire for freedom. What I do with my body is my choice. You can't tell me, you can't take that away from me. My guns are protected by the Constitution. Both sides weigh morality against freedom. Is it any surprise which argument wins out? I often wonder what would happen if a politician came along and said, hey, what about a compromise? Let's write a bill and put in it that both owning guns and abortion are illegal. Like, my guess is he'd finally achieve his goal of bringing both sides together. And both left and right would pick up stones and stone him to death on the spot. Don't mess with our freedom. We earned it. Oh, and yes, God is still my king and all that. All right, is God my help? Do I believe that God can deliver me? If I do, then I should be willing to put my trust in him in every situation, knowing that he has the power to deliver me. That doesn't mean that he will. But if I do that, then I know that at the end, whether I'm delivered or not, God will be glorified. But that's kind of the hard part, that not. Like, he might not actually deliver me in this one situation, and I really want to be delivered. Possibly more than I want God to be glorified. Is that what we face? Who is what God is? Many try to make themselves out as God. They can offer gifts and power and make you great, but we must remember that their power is not their own. It comes from God, and he can choose to bestow it on whom he wishes. Ultimately, I need to know that God is my judge. He is judge over all men. Your days are numbered, and at the end, God will weigh you. Will you be found wanting? Or will he find someone who spent their time putting their trust in him? The final question is what I think the whole of the book is, do I believe that God is in control? It's a simple question, but the answer should reach into every aspect of my life. Do I put my trust in earthly kings or in the King of Kings? The reason I think we can spend so much time in Daniel, the second half of Daniel, and Revelation, arguing over these visions, over no, it's not this kingdom that he's talking about, it's this kingdom, is because they really describe every kingdom. Every nation is Babylon. That's why 600 years later, Revelation can take similar visions of Babylon and relate them to other kingdoms. I mean, we want to think ours is different. America is a Christian nation, but no, it's not. America, like every earthly kingdom, is Babylon. We are exiles here. We live in this kingdom, but we actually are members of a Christian nation. God's kingdom, the church. And our kingdom will last from generation to generation. Our kingdom is forever. Why give your loyalty to any other? I want to be clear that, like, all this is not to say you should disobey our leaders or rebel against them or be disrespectful toward them. The opposite. As Peter said in 1 Peter 2:17, honor the emperor. But we aren't to honor him based on his policies or what he does for us. We're to honor him because we recognize that he was put in that position by God. The Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. When Peter wrote to honor the emperor at that time, as most of us know, was Nero. And if what we know of that is correct, he probably set fire to Rome, but then he blamed Christians for that and then had Christians impaled on sticks and set on fire as torches. And around 2 years after Peter wrote, "Honor the Emperor," Nero had him crucified upside down. We're not to honor our leaders because of what they do for us, but because we recognize, even in dire circumstances, that God is in control. And though we honor the king, we have to make sure that our most important consideration is God and his people. For the last thing, let's turn over to 2 Timothy 3. We usually read the first five verses and a list like this and have people in the world in mind because it's a lot of worldly stuff. But I want to read this, and as we're reading it, think about how many of these can be applied to what we've been talking about tonight. But realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. For men will be lovers of self, lovers of money. I'm going to skip around just a little bit. Boastful, arrogant, revilers, unholy, which is not separate, unloving, irreconcilable, treacherous, sold our loyalty away from God, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, and this one especially, holding to a form of godliness, although they have denied its power. Do any of these describe how we act when it comes to our politics? We're told to avoid such men as these. Chapter 3, verse 7. Always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. That's describing those who are seeking after the king's wisdom rather than God's. Verse 13. But evil men and imposters will proceed from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived. You, however, continue in the things you have learned and become convinced of, knowing from whom you have learned them, and that from childhood you have known the sacred writings, which are able to give you the wisdom that leads to salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. Make sure we're not the evil man or the imposter, but rather we're seeking that wisdom from God that leads to salvation. Chapter 4, verses 6 through 8. Paul ends his letter with the same thought that Daniel did. But when Daniel says, he's told, as for you, go your way to the end, then you will enter into rest and rise again for your allotted portion at the end of days. Here's Paul's. For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. In the future, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all those who have loved his appearing. In case not quite convinced that Daniel's in the background here, let's look at the end here, verse 16. At my first defense, no one supported me, but all deserted me. May it not be counted against them, but the Lord stood with me and strengthened me, so that through me the proclamation might be fulfilled, and that all the Gentiles might hear. And I was rescued out of the lion's mouth. The Lord will rescue me from every evil deed, and will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. To him be the glory forever and ever. Amen. What's interesting, Paul's already confirmed that he's being poured out like a drink offering. He's already accepted his end. When he says, "When the Lord will rescue me, the Lord will deliver me," what he actually has in mind there seems to be death. The Lord's going to deliver him through death. God will save me from this evil world and deliver me into his heavenly kingdom. So in conclusion, I just want to make clear, I'm not telling you to ignore all politics or not vote or become a separatist or anything. But I do want to leave you with two thoughts. One, when you find yourself becoming extremely attached to the politics of the nation, to politicians in particular, ask yourself, what's my motivation? Am I truly worried about God's name being glorified, or am I seeking my own interests? And two, as Christians, We should always stand up against sin. Short of that, realize that no matter how right you think your view is, there are Christians on the other side who feel just as strongly. And so is anything you're doing going to cause one of them to stumble? Cause a non-believer to blaspheme the name you should put above all names? So whether it's putting catchy slogans on bumper stickers or sharing memes on Facebook, we, God's chosen people, members of His everlasting kingdom, too often find ourselves picking sides between the king of the north and the king of the south, and wage war on our brethren without ever picking up a weapon. And we create a divide between us based on which king we've pledged our loyalty to. And we sold our trust for whatever our current favorite leader has promised us: freedom, security, economic prosperity. And what we forget, what we've forgotten, is that God is in control and that Christ reigns supreme. And His dominion is an everlasting dominion. And He is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever He wishes. Say a prayer. O Lord, the great and awesome God, who keeps Your covenant and loving kindness for those who love You and keep Your commandments, we have sinned, committed iniquity, acted wickedly, and rebelled against You by putting our trust in princes and in ourselves and in our riches. O Lord, forgive. And let Your face shine on us, that as Your people, called by Your name, we may desire Your will to be done in all things. May we not attempt to bend Your will to our own, but rather trust that You are in control. And help us to go our way until the end, choosing Your glory in all things, both in life and in death, knowing that after which we will enter rest and rise again for our allotted portion at the end of the days. Amen. If you're here tonight and you've put your trust in the kings of this earth rather than the King of Kings, I want you to question why. Because the kings of this earth have their power given to them and have their power taken away by our King. He's the one you should put your trust in. If you need help from anyone here, if you need prayers, if you want to finally put your trust in God once and for all, if you haven't done that by being baptized into Christ's death and being raised into His kingdom, do so as we stand and sing.